Okay, well, good morning. It's really great to see all of you guys here and still here. And I hope you had a good Valentine's Day with your colleagues. I'm Dixie Ching. This is Jonathan Fry. We're doc students at the at NYU, New York University, in the Educational Communication and Technology program. And we're also members of the Games for Learning Institute, which we'll be talking about in a few moments. We're both learning game designers and researchers, and today we'll be describing the G4LI method of designing learning games. G4LI is what we call Games for Learning Institute. First of all, I just wanted to get a show of hands. Who plays video games on consoles, computers, iPads, or iPhones? Awesome. And who has designed games on any of those devices? Okay, cool. So we'll try to keep the jargon to a minimum. And describe any of the games that you may not be familiar with. We'll mainly be using iPad, iPhone games as our examples. So please shout out a question or raise your hand if you need clarification. It's a small enough group that you should really feel free to do that. And it's really important for us that you come away from the session with a better sense of how learning games are structured and how one might be able to employ a more rigorous and thoughtful design approach to such games. And I also wanted to add that even if you don't consider yourself a game designer or don't plan to design games, I think our talk, which involves breaking games down into constituent parts, will allow you to better evaluate the quality and potential of learning games. For example, after our talk, hopefully you'll be able to see the difference between a game which feels like the learning is baked right in versus a game where the learning aspect was sort of an afterthought, you know, that dreaded chocolate-covered broccoli situation. And finally, I wanted to mention that the hashtags are ELI and G4LI, so for the folks watching this from home, feel free to answer a question, and we have this wonderful woman here who will make sure your questions get answered either during the session or afterwards. So why don't we begin? So I'll be giving the overview of the Games for Learning Institute, and then a quick overview of learning games, and then Jonathan Fry will go over our design process, and then give you a concrete example vis-a-vis the Noobs versus Elite geometry game. So the Games for Learning Institute is a multi-university research consortium, and we've been focusing on STEM games for middle school students, and it's we're funded by Microsoft Research and Motorola Foundation. Our driving question is, how can we design games for learning? So we use findings from the fields of education and research, education and psychology, to develop design patterns that are then empirically validated through our research activities. And our focus is largely on the development of STEM knowledge and digital literacy. And we don't design in a vacuum. We are heavily invested in working with the intended audiences of our games. So we do a lot of prototyping and play testing, and that usually results in a lot of design iterations. And well, that was our colleague Murphy getting a lot of tough feedback from his from middle school students. So here are some games that we've designed. This is an augmented reality simulation game, which had geolocated hot zones and an authentic data feed. Students were asked to answer questions around energy consumption. This is a math game that helped kids become more familiar with math transformations like translation, reflection, rotation, and dilation. This is Factor Reactor, a math fluency game. And this is our geometry game, Noobs versus Elites, which Jonathan will talk about. So why games for learning? So games have a tremendous potential to positively affect learning in many ways. For example, if designed appropriately, games can present highly contextualized spaces where learning is situated. And as you know, when something is learned in a context that makes sense to you, there's a higher likelihood that you'll be able to apply that knowledge in the future. Games can also be highly engaging to a player and individualized to their specific needs, something that's sort of more difficult in a school setting. They can also help learners develop 21st century skills, such as collaboration, creativity, and problem solving. And the Higher Ed Horizon report that came out a few days ago also mentioned that very same point. They're used in schools and after-school programs, which makes them a perfect way to bridge the two environments and achieve a seamless 360-degree learning situation for the child. And games allow for embedded assessment, not just for learning outcomes, but for other important variables as well, like player spatial ability, verbal ability, goal orientation, self-regulation, and emotional states. And if that's more, I guess, cutting edge type of research in terms of that field. So Jonathan can definitely answer your questions if you have any around that after the talk. However, as I said earlier, to realize the potential of games, one must pay very close attention to its design. And here are also some major functions of games for learning. This is a nice way to, I guess, organize like the many different types of games out there. First of all, this is really interesting. Researchers have found that games can help prepare future learning. So if you have kids play a game and they get more familiar with the context, they then are better able to dive into the curriculum later on. Games can also help teach specific learning goals and skills. They're also games that help automatization and fluency, and they can develop 21st century skills, as I mentioned earlier. So now I'll hand it over to John.
Can everybody hear me? Okay. So some of the stuff that I'm going to be talking about is a little bit complicated. Thankfully, most of you raised your hands when you said, I play games and I'm familiar with games. Feel free to stop and ask me a question or just raise your hand or whatever. Also, we have a very practical example of how we applied the process to one of our games. So if you're a little bit confused, as I get to that, it'll probably make more sense. So let's start with, so the way that the Games for Learning Institute takes its initiative towards designing a new game is to divide it up into three areas: game mechanics, learning mechanics, and assessment mechanics. First off, I'm going to talk about game mechanics just to make sure everyone kind of understands. There's probably like 50 definitions of game mechanics if you look anywhere. Sometimes they're considered like methods to invoke agents, other times they're patterns of behavior, or probably one of the most popular ones is Salen and Zimmerman from the Game Design Reader or Games in Play. And basically, game mechanics are the things that make up the game. Like when we talk about a core game mechanic, that's the moment-to-moment activity that that happens in the game. So in a game like Angry Birds, the core game mechanic of this is the drawback and fling mechanic. If anyone's not familiar, I'll show a video in a second. Here, I might as well just go ahead and do that. Here, in case anyone's not familiar with Angry Birds, super popular, incredible number of things sold. Oh, I'm sorry. So basically, it's this fling mechanic where you just drag your finger back, let it go, and then there's like simulated physics to knock things down and you get points. So the core mechanic of this game is just the fling mechanic. But then there's several other mechanics like points and physics and the scoring system and all that kind of stuff. So generally, just game mechanics are the like core activities that occur in the game. Let me go back to this real quick. And then Flight Control is another like popular iPhone game. It has a very similar interaction where you're dragging your finger across the screen, but it has very different game mechanic because you're not like releasing it to fly off. You're directing where it goes. So although it has the same interaction, the game mechanic is actually very different. In our approach to games, we have something that we call learning mechanics. Basically, these are designed for several things. First, to engage meaningful learning activity. The second is to elicit behaviors that can be observed. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more when we talk about assessment mechanics, because we want to see how learning is occurring and what patterns of learning we're seeing. And then, of course, be fun and engaging, because like Dixie said, we don't want the chocolate-covered broccoli. We want them to actually be like, oh, this is a game I could take home and play on my own and stuff like that and still be learning. So to get more into like a definition of what learning mechanics are, there's, along with game mechanics, there are patterns of learning, of behavior and building blocks, but it's of learner interactivity. It's not just what's happening with the game, the core game mechanics. They may be a single action or set of interrelated actions. It's very similar to game mechanics, but you're looking at specific learning activities and designing for specific learning activities in the game. A good way to think about this, if it's a little bit confusing, is We start with learning mechanics as like a meta approach. We design what our learning mechanics are going to be for the game, and then we start applying game design mechanics to that. And it'll make a little bit more sense when I get to our applied version. And then, of course, it has to be grounded in specific learning theories so that we can know that what we're doing has been proven to be effective. So, for example, here, one of our learning mechanics that we use a lot is apply rules to solve problems. I mean, that's very general, and that, like I said, it's a meta approach. So we start with this, and then we apply game design principles to that. So here's an instance, and this is actually the one that we used in our geometry game, is for, we wanted them to learn how to solve for different angles. So in this case, they're given the rule of what kind of angle might be involved in the puzzle, and then they have to drag it to the empty space. This is just an example. This isn't exactly how it looks in the game. This is kind of like what a paper prototype of the mechanic would look like. But I'll show it in action here in a little bit. So example, so there are a lot of ways that you can apply, and this is what I was getting at earlier with the interaction can apply a lot to the game mechanic. So if we wanted to use the game mechanic from Angry Birds of the pull and fling it, that really doesn't work for this because if they miss, and if they choose the right rule and they miss, that's not really assessing anything. That's basically they couldn't handle the game mechanic, but they actually knew what they were doing and the learning was there, but you can't, and you have no evidence of that because if they miss and they have to retry, just because they can't get the game mechanic down instead of not because they don't know the learning objective. Another example of the learning mechanic is create a series of interrelated solutions. So this is like the Rube Goldberg machine I'm sure everyone's familiar with. Basically setting up multiple stages of a solution, each one having to be correct. And then like Bejeweled has something where you're matching sets. A lot of mechanics can be taken from commercial games. Finally, I'm going to talk about assessment mechanics, and then I'll get into our practical example from one of our games. So assessment mechanics are all about diagnostic activities. So what you're looking for is evidence of learning, patterns of interactions, maybe even things like how their situated interest changes, how their enjoyment of the game changes, in addition to just learning activities. So here's an example of how an assessment mechanic might become involved. So in this version of the prototype, instead of asking them what rule they're applying, we're asking them to solve the equation. So that gives us a more detailed evidence of their learning because we know, oh, they actually were able to figure out the exact answer in that problem. Whereas in this one, they're only telling us what rule you would apply, so they're not actually calculating, but maybe they're not so good in math skills, but they understand geometry a little bit better. So if we use a mechanic like this, we can show that they have an understanding of the concepts of geometry, but maybe they just don't get the math involved with calculating the angles. But with this one, we know that they can figure it out on their own, but we don't know the reason behind it unless we do something like a think aloud or specifically ask them to tell us. So you have to really think about when you're designing your assessment mechanic, what are you looking for and why? So one of the things that we use to help us frame this is called evidence-centered design. So there's the student competency model is like what should be assessed. So that's what you kind of do before you start implementing your assessment mechanics is what do we want kids to learn out of this? Like in my previous example, do we want them to show that they can calculate the angle or do we want them to show that they know the rules involved and know the conceptual level thinking? The evidence model, what behaviors reveal these constructs? So that's more of what specifically are they doing in the game. That's information that you would pull from the log files. Like you would save specific information to the log, have the game write specific information to the log file that you could then go back later and pull information from. For anyone that's familiar with Jim G's work, this is the whole idea of, well, if someone plays the game, you don't need to test them afterwards because you already know if they're successful at learning it or not. So we're kind of trying to make that in a more applied sense. If someone plays one of our games, we can look that back through the log files and see they know this content or they need help in these few areas. And then same thing with the task model. What task should elicit these behaviors? So that's what what behaviors they're exhibiting within the game. So criteria for assessment mechanics, like I just said, they're based on the evidence model and describe aspects of the task model, and they test theoretical concerns. For time's sake, I'm going to go through this a little bit quicker. And then assessment character may or may not be obvious to the learner. So that's something that we try to do a lot, is the assessment mechanics are embedded within the game so that the kids don't know they're being tested. They can feel free to try things and experiment, and it's not something where they're like, oh, am I being tested on this? Like, one of the things that happens when we give pre-tests to kids in schools is they're always like, oh, is my teacher going to find out about this? Where's this grade going to go? But in games, you don't have to do that. You can, even if you have a point system, it doesn't necessarily have to be related to the game or to the learning mechanic. It can be related to game mechanics, where they still feel successful despite the fact that they might be actually struggling with the learning mechanic. So there's a few requirements for selecting a game mechanic for learning, or any mechanic in a learning game, is we want to make sure that we have game mechanics that are based on the assessment mechanics so that we can have that good data afterwards, like through the log files. One thing, I'm not sure how familiar you are with cognitive load, but essentially we don't want to introduce mechanics into the game that are going to increase cognitive load to the point where the game becomes difficult, and where the learning mechanics might be fine and they can handle that just fine. But then you throw in all these activities, like in the Angry Birds example, you add the fling mechanic. That really has nothing to do with whether they're learning what to do, but it adds a level of cognitive load, like, oh, I need to figure out where I need to place this and all that kind of stuff. We try to avoid that at all costs. Along the same lines, you want there to have a certain amount of germane cognitive load, our mental effort in order to learn the content. Fine motor skills. You don't want any mechanics that are revolving around fine motor skills, because that's not what you're, unless it's a game that's what you want to teach. And certainly that makes a lot of sense. But you don't want a game where you're trying to teach geometry, but they can't show that they know geometry because their fine motor skills aren't good enough. That's not something that kids can get very frustrated with that easily. And then to show content knowledge or skills. And then emotional response. Jan likes to put this with, he likes the Angry Birds example. He's our advisor. You want to take into account what the emotional response from the mechanics that you put into the game is going to be. Obviously, you want to limit frustration, but you can also elicit a lot of positive emotions, too, through the game mechanics you design or through the design of the games. One of the research studies that we just came out with not too long ago from the Institute was a study where we showed that having warm colors worked with one population, but having cooler colors worked with a different population. So you want to look at what kids you're targeting and what might work better. So we're trying to develop a library of learning mechanics. This is something that's still a work in progress, and we're seeing what commercial games use. Although most of these games are not learning or educational games at all, they still have learning elements in them. Like, all games have a tutorial. All games have elements where you start and you don't know what you're doing. So we're trying to build this up, and hopefully this will be available on our website as we add more and more to it. Sure.
So there's a question from an online viewer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the question is, are your games available on mobile devices? If so, then how do you get the results?
We have a grant from Motorola to do more games that are mobile, on mobile devices like phones and everything. We can still instrument some log file stuff on that. And then the other thing is we actually will just videotape the interactions and we can code everything later. In the first year that I worked at the Games for Learning Institute, we actually just watched kids play commercial games and we would film absolutely everything that they did, in order to understand what was eliciting positive emotions, able to learn through the tutorials and things, and then that's how we came up with design patterns that have really influenced a lot of the games that we're designing now. So to recap a little bit before I talk about one of our games, so you want to develop learning mechanics based on theory. I know it's a little confusing because I talked about game mechanics first, but we actually, in our design process, we start with the learning mechanics and then develop game mechanics that apply. And then step three, we create assessment mechanics so that we can evaluate learning.
Maybe we could stop here to see if anyone has any questions before we go into an example.
Okay.
And I just want to mention that even though sometimes we are creating new mechanics, as John showed, there's a library that we're developing, so eventually we might be able to pick a good, an appropriate mechanic based on the goals that we've identified.
Right. Exactly. Thank you, Dixie. So Noobs versus Leets, as Dixie mentioned earlier, is a game that we designed to teach geometry skills. The name of the game came from our middle school students that we work with. They thought that was wonderful. So the primary learning mechanic for the game is apply rules to solve problems, but there are other ones as well. Since for the research prototype, we wanted it to actually be able to teach and not just be like a drill and practice game. So we have built-in cutscenes explaining what each geometry rule, so what the complementary rule is, what the supplementary rule is, things like that. And then there's also other things like progressive scaffolding and reciprocal teaching that we're implementing in the game as well. And we took a lot of inspiration from commercial games, kind of like, and I think you'll see, we originally started with ideas from like World of Goo and then went on. As Dixie talked about earlier, we worked directly with middle school students. We had lots of iteration and playtesting. And a lot of our game mechanics came up from things that they inspired us with, their ideas that they had from just having game design meetings with them. So here's a working concept. So this goes back to the assessing the learning mechanic that I was talking about earlier. So in this case, so to explain the game a little bit, you play as a little noob who's at the top, and you want to save your friend from the cage. So you have to solve the angles which will unlock these lines in order to save your friend. Well, in this version of the game, you're solving for the angle. You're actually calculating. And this is an early stage. There's six chapters in the game, and each chapter has like eight levels. So this is still fairly early in the game. So there's only four choices because it's introducing this topic. But normally, they have to actually calculate the specific number. Whereas in this version of the game, they have to select what rule applies. So what we were doing with this study is actually trying to figure out what worked better. Was it that they could demonstrate the numerical knowledge of how to calculate, or was it better that they could show that they understood the rule? So we developed two versions. I'm going to show a little video of the game, and hopefully this will help everything make a little bit more sense.
Noobs versus Leets is a single-player game designed to teach middle school students basic geometry concepts ranging from complementary and supplementary angles to the triangle and quadrilateral rules. The design of Noobs versus Leets is based on research about the benefits of reciprocal teaching, where players assume the role of the teacher. When the game begins, the players find out that the friendly noobs are in trouble and that they need the players' help to find their friends and protect them from the evil Leets. Each area of the map leads to a different chapter that introduces a new geometry concept. At the beginning of each chapter, the player learns about this new concept. The player then teaches the noobs what they learned. The player first selects the angles by clicking on them, and then unlocks them by choosing the appropriate solution. Unlocking the angle unlocks all lines involved in that angle, allowing the noob to move closer to his end goal of freeing his friend. In order to support transfer of their knowledge to new problems, the different levels of the game present the problems in different contexts and skins. Challenges added by stationary leets that act as obstacles, blocking the noob's ability to walk down lines, and by moving leets, which will start to move around the level at random when their line is unlocked. For our research, this game was further modified in several different ways. The first variation was designed to study the effectiveness of the learning mechanic where the player applies rules to solve problems. Two different game versions were created, a rule version and an arithmetic version. The rule condition asked players to choose the rule that would unlock an unknown angle. The arithmetic condition asked players to calculate the exact value of the unknown angle. Our study was designed to investigate differences in learning outcomes for the rule versus the arithmetic conditions, and to explore the impact of learners' prior geometry and arithmetic knowledge and interest in math on learning from the two game variants. Another variation of Noobs vs. Elites was designed to study the impact of different badges on learning. One badge type utilizes extrinsic motivation, comparing the player's performance to the performance of others. The second badge type utilizes intrinsic motivation, providing feedback aimed at improving player performance to the best of their own abilities. For more information on this and our other games and research,
all right, so just to clarify that this is, we're focusing on middle school here.
Yes, middle school STEM topics.
The other question is, how are you addressing accessibility issues in game design?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by accessibility issues.
Well, no, that's a really great point to make, actually, and I just had the pleasure of meeting Matt Marino, who's done some really great work with Universal Designs for Learning, if you guys have heard of that, and David Rose at CAST. And I think we're all, even though we don't specifically, we may not have addressed that in our design process, as designers who constantly do a lot of play testing and focus grouping with our middle school students, we are keeping an eye out for usability issues from all sorts of, you know, types of kids, and that includes kids with learning disabilities or, you know, like we said, fine motor skill issues. That's why we try to make sure that nothing is too difficult to play through, but it at the same time is still fun. But I think in the future we'll probably we'll probably look into that and maybe create, you know, like a separate track of, you know, research or do like a white paper, because that is a really interesting question, and there are, you know, like SBIR kind of grants that are trying to urge more focus in that area.
I would also say to that question that we have very multidisciplinary teams. So our game design team for us would be programmers, psychologists, game designers, educational technologists, and all that kind of stuff. I designed the levels for this, and before I came to this program, I was a school psychologist. So I actually thought about a lot of that stuff, about how someone with learning disabilities might encounter this game and how their perceptions might change towards math and things like that. And as you saw, some of the simple levels of the game aren't much more than multiple choice. There's only one angle to solve, and then they've got to figure out based on the choices that they're given, and that's done on purpose in order to kind of assess whether they just got what they got what the previous cutscene was explaining to them. But then as they go on, I mentioned a little bit earlier about progressive scaffolding. As the levels get harder and harder, not only do they have to apply what they just learned, they have to apply what they learned in the previous chapters, and they have to problem solve how to get from point A to point B, because there are lots of complex lines, lots of different scenarios and ways of doing it. And then for the assessment, we actually keep log file data of pretty much everything that they do in the game, from clicking on things that don't matter to correct, incorrect answers and all that kind of stuff. So just to summarize a little bit, so the design of game mechanics benefits from the separation of learning mechanics and assessment mechanics. This is something that has really helped with our design of in-house games, because we're starting with learning first instead of trying to apply learning to game mechanics that are already out there, or coming up with games where they end up with pop-ups that try to ask questions and stuff like that. We try to avoid that kind of stuff, and starting with the learning really makes a big difference. And then with the assessment mechanics, we have such rich amounts of data afterwards that we can assess what the kids learned. In the case that that I showed with the two different types of the game, we actually were able to show that while high expertise users liked the number version better, low expertise users liked the conceptual game. Or wait, was it the other way around? Do you remember? I'm trying to remember. I think that's the way it was. So people that were familiar with geometry Like the conceptual version, and people that were not familiar with geometry like the number version, which is kind of counterintuitive to what you might expect. I guess they since they were used to working with numbers in school, it felt a little bit safer. But yeah, so that was one of the studies that we were working on, and the video showed the next study. We're developing two versions of the game, one which will have mastery badges and one which will have performance badges. Mastery goal orientation meaning oh, I want to improve my own skills, I want to be better for my own reasons, more intrinsically motivated, whereas the performance badges are more, I did better than other people, and I want to compare my own performance to what other students in the class are doing. And that's research we're actually doing right now, so that hopefully that will be out soon. We use evidence-centered design and learning theory to ground everything that all the mechanics that we come up with for learning mechanics. And then multiple game mechanics in multiple game genres are possible for each learning mechanic. So, like, what I mean by that is the example of the fling mechanic from Angry Birds. You could really apply that game mechanic to multiple learning mechanics, but in some cases it might be appropriate, in some cases it might just interfere or cause poor cognitive load or assess fine motor skills when that's really not what you're looking for. Also, you want to consider additional confounds or constraints that they introduce, which I was just mentioning. So we actually have for anyone that wants more detailed information about this, we have a white paper that's available on our website. We also have a forthcoming book chapter in the Game Metrics and Telemetry book, which should be out, I think, in the fall. Feel free to contact me or Dixie with any questions that you might have. And I'd be glad to answer questions now if you have any.
So far you talked about kind of digital games. How would you start the process with, say, a college professor that was looking to do kind of face-to-face in-class games? Like, what kind of questions would you initially want to know the answers to?
We start with what the learning goals are. And then we kind of build from there to see what kind of learning mechanics might apply, and then start developing games. Like, this doesn't only apply to digital games. Like, we have done, and actually, pretty much everything that we do, we paper prototype anyway, and it has almost a working paper version before we even transfer it to digital. Does that answer your question? Anybody else? Yeah. So he asked if we have an asset library where we can use reuse things over and over, like assets from the game. We currently are reusing a lot of stuff in terms of setting up different studies. Like, we did the original study, which was the conceptual versus the arithmetic, and the next study is different badge versions. But to be honest, we also partner with local game design companies. And this is just stuff that we did in-house. Like, we didn't actually have an artist, per se, working on this. So what we did was we created a design document of the things that were able to make it into the game and things that weren't. Like, the reciprocal teaching sort of made it into the game, but there's this big, long narrative that also goes with it and stuff like that, and all that's in our design document. And we're actually currently working with a company to have them professionally develop it based on our design document. Our game is pretty cute, and I'm very proud of it, but I think if we gave it to a game design company, they could increase access quite a bit. And it's something that we would make available on our website and free and all that kind of stuff.
And I just want to mention that I'm also on a project called the Math Fluency Data Collaborative. It's funded by the NGLC, and one of my colleagues, John Stamper, is over there. It's with people at Carnegie Learning and Carnegie Mellon University. And we are producing these simple math game frameworks and assets, art and music, and we're releasing it all openly and using Creative Commons licenses. And we hope that people will be able to access it and change the games however they want, use our assets or improve them and do all sorts of stuff.
Anyone else? Oh, right.
Is there any taxonomy emerging around different kinds of gamers?
Actually, that is my dissertation. So he, I'll repeat the question. So he was asking about, he was saying that he was interested in the study about warm colors versus cold colors with different populations, and if there's any kind of taxonomy coming out. To be honest, that is my dissertation topic. There's a lot of research done on, like, what motivates players. There's a lot in, like, terms of uses and gratifications of games, things like that. And then in the game design world, like, all game designers have these ideas of what players are like. So, like, Richard Bartle, who's pretty famous game designer for multi-user domains, which are kind of like MMOs, like World of Warcraft, if anyone's not familiar. So he was one of the ones that, like, started this conversation with, oh, there's four types of players. There's the socializer that just plays the game to hang out with people and talk about stuff. There's the achiever that wants to get as far in the game as possible. There's the killer that just wants to ruin everybody else's fun and stuff like that. So in my dissertation, I'm working on combining what game designers have said with the research that's been done so far on in social science and with empirical data, because no one's lined those things up yet. Like, no one's based their social science research on what game designers said, and game designers aren't reading what social science researchers are doing. So there needs to be a lot more collaboration with that. And I'm hoping to have some of that data available soon, but we'll see.
Another question from an online viewer, Kathy Ischler, asked, the lesson screen in the game had a close box. Can your students close the lesson and still play the game? In other words, do you allow students to just click their way past the lessons, or do they have to watch the lesson first?
They are actually able to close the lesson, and what we do is we time how long that they watched it in order to compare that later to how well they were doing in the game. So we can see, oh, they thought they knew this, but they really didn't. The other thing is, I don't know if you could notice it, but there was a little movie button in the bottom right. So anytime they started struggling, they could also go back to the lesson and watch it over again. So we could time how long and how many times they watched the video. Anyone else? All right, well, thank you very much. I appreciate you all coming to watch this, and I hope we provided you with some helpful information.